the central dilemma in the Euthyphro dialogue about whether something is pious because it's loved by the gods, or it's loved by the gods because it's pious. One of those sort of common sense dialogues that are paradoxes that we've been talking about. I want to talk for the rest of today's episode on another ancient Greek, contemporary of Socrates, more or less, who also is famous for composing a whole list of paradoxes. Now, no one really knows exactly why he was pushed to do this, why he came up with this list. There are some theories. But of course, I'm talking about Zeno. So Zeno of Elea, 5th century BC, so, you know, estimated maybe 490 was BC was when he was born. And he's known for this list of philosophical but also logical and mathematical paradoxes. So typically it's said that he aimed to defend his mentor, Parmenides, with these sort of paradoxical discussions, because Parmenides was a proponent of monism, which I won't get far into that for this, the purposes of this discussion, but basically it's conceptualizing the world as one thing or a collection of many things. And there are, the monism argument kind of falls apart logically, but it seems Zeno may have decided to go on this project to continue to explore paradoxes as a result of that. Hard to say. But there's two paradoxes in particular I want to talk about. And you're going to notice that these are a little bit different than the Euthyphro dilemma. They are a little more the logical paradoxes I was talking about, where the logic seems to start from, you know, valid inferences and acceptable premises and get to conclusions that just don't seem to pan out in the real world. So let me get us started on one example and we'll get to talking about it. And this is the Achilles and the tortoise, or Achilles and the hare paradox. So, I'll quote here from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, taken from Simplicius, his work on Aristotle's Physics, and he tackles some of Zeno's paradoxes in this work, and he says, "The second argument was called Achilles, accordingly from the fact that Achilles was taken as a character in it, and the argument says that it is impossible for him to overtake the tortoise when pursuing it. For in fact it is necessary that what is to overtake something, before overtaking it, first reach the limit from which what is fleeing set forth." So just to translate that, it's you have to reach the point that the object you're chasing was at before in order to keep getting closer to it. "In the time at which what is pursuing arrives at this point, what is fleeing will advance a certain interval, even if it's less than that which what is pursuing advanced." So even if the thing that you're chasing is moving slower than you, it will move in the time it takes you to reach the point it used to be. "And in the time again in which what is pursuing will traverse this interval, which what is fleeing advanced, in this time again what is fleeing will traverse some amount." So on and so on. "And thus, in every time in which what is pursuing will traverse the interval which what is fleeing, being slower, has already advanced, what is fleeing will also advance some amount." And so the problem, basically, with this paradox is, if you think of it mathematically, let's say that the tortoise is exactly half your speed, and you're Achilles. You're a great runner. You're going to chase this turtle. You're going to catch it. It moves 10 meters. And in that time, you move, let's say, 6 meters closer to it. But in the time it took you to move 6 meters, it moves another 3. In the time it takes you to catch up those 3, it moves another 1.5 meters. So what happens is you get an infinite an infinite series of distances to cross between you and the thing you're chasing, where it's always going to be some distance ahead of you if you're both always moving, even if they get infinitesimally small. So this is Zeno's paradox. Obviously, it's a paradox because if you look in the real world and you go chase a turtle, you're probably going to catch it. I don't know. Some turtles move pretty fast, actually. But let's say most people, if you're going to go out and chase a tortoise, you're going to catch it. So what exactly is the problem here? And I know, Aaron, that you are familiar with the math that we've come to know since this time that explains how this works in the real world. And I'll get you to explain that in just a moment. But I want to clarify for our audience, that's why this is a paradox, right? Because seemingly, the math ain't mathing, to use an expression my friends really like. For Zeno, it seemed the math wasn't mathing, that somehow, if you're doing this calculation, you're never going to catch it. And yet in the real world, you see it that you in fact will.
I do want to approach this kind of from a couple perspectives. So the first one seems to me, at least, to be a proto attempt at developing the idea of a limit. So for those of you who have taken courses in calculus, a limit is essentially saying that if a really easy example of this is when you have a graph that has a curve that goes towards something infinitely. So for instance, if you have a curve that is going straight up at point zero, then you'd say that at that point it tends towards infinity. So when you're dealing with things at infinity, a whole bunch of odd things can happen. There's a whole bunch of tools that we've invented to deal with stuff like that. With this specific example, the question kind of is like, well, if one thing is moving slowly but is always moving, and you're moving closer to it but it's always in front of you, then you can never catch up to the thing in front of you. The answer to that, and I did look up a little bit of a proof that went through this, is that the flaw in Zeno's argument is his unstated assumption that the sum of an infinite series cannot be finite. So essentially you have two infinite series and you're assuming that they cannot equal a finite result. Whereas we have some math today that shows that there are some series that do, even infinite series, that do converge to numerical results, which is what you see in the real world.
This is an example of a kind of paradox that simply relied on knowledge that was unavailable at the time as far as proper mathematical proofs for this kind of thing went. So Zeno didn't have knowledge of infinite series converging on a finite sum to explain why the math wasn't working out, which, by the way, the fact that he was doing this kind of math in the first place at that time, I mean, he was quite close. He just was missing this step that we've developed since. So that's what happens sometimes with these paradoxes, is that they're not so much philosophically interesting, let's say, in that they question ethics or, you know, they like Euthyphro, but they're important because they show us that it could be the result of a lack of knowledge in a particular sense, or it could be the result of something else or a mistaken premise or something like that.
Something that I also want to comment here that's very interesting that I know from studying the history of math is often the develop of mathematical ideas on a certain subject, it's really surprising. Like, you can go thousands or hundreds of years with basically no work done, and then all of a sudden someone looks at the problem in a totally different way and invents a concept or develops notation and words to describe a concept we already had that lets us take apart a problem in a slightly different way. And then people build off of that work, and then, you know, 110 years later, that type of thing happens again. And this is kind of the wonderful thing of living in a world post-printing press and post-internet, is that there's so much information that I guess you could say, like, there's never been a more exciting time to study mathematics because we have so many tools at your disposal. Like, you could study mathematics your entire life and not learn like a significant fraction of the mathematical tools and ideas that we have for various subjects.
I'm not a mathematician. I'm a philosophy student. So I can't, like, obviously I can't speak to, well, it's wrong, but that's not what I want to say at all. I do concede that, well, I guess I should preface a lot of this by saying I actually am kind of interested in defending maybe the utility of this paradox. I feel like I kind of understand why the paradox exists. Well, maybe Zeno really thought that he was coming to the truth, that this stuff really followed from the mathematics that he was using. But I think that this does go back to his mentor, Parmenides. To go back to what you mentioned in your definition of paradoxes, and I was actually kind of surprised to see that this was in the definition, was that paradoxes, can we use the word paradox to describe situations where common sense is kind of overridden, right? Like, this is a very nonsensical situation, Achilles not being able to catch up to a hare, much less a tortoise. It's an attempt to illustrate, or it's an attempt to prove that motion is not real. And that's also something that Parmenides argues for in his so-called didactic poem. He talks about the steady heart of well-rounded truth. I mean, he says that truth is like a perfect sphere. There's no differentiation between it. And this is going back to what you're saying about the monism. There's lots of reasons to disagree with monism, but this is what Parmenides is arguing for. One of the necessary consequences of Parmenidean monism is that motion isn't a thing. And so this is an attempt to illustrate or overcome what this is an attempt to bring the mind to realizing that, or glimpsing what motion not being a thing might look like. So I kind of read this more as like a spiritual practice in overcoming something like, you know, our necessarily temporal perception of the world. I mean, there is, and you can, Aaron, if you want to correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard from people who've done some reading that physics does seem to think that there is a kind of illusory part of our perceptions of time. I mean, my experience of time is not even consistent. My experience of time is not consistent. Sometimes I sleep, sometimes I get bored and things drag on, sometimes I'm having fun and things go by way faster. I like defending Zeno's paradox, not because I think it's correct. I mean, it's demonstrably false mathematically, but I think it's interesting if you confine it to philosophically bringing yourself to human limits, temporal limits. It's a glimpse of seeing what time and motion as an absurdity looks like under a Parmenidean perspective.
That's a very good insight, Brandon, because you're right. Like, we can all imagine this happening because of how human beings experience time in the physical world. And you can actually imagine that, you know, you're experiencing a moment in time, and then that moment gets slower, and it gets slower, and it gets slower, and it gets slower. And like, you know, we have movies now. It's a lot easier for us to imagine that type of thing. The question of how human beings perceive time and what time is as a physical property does have some philosophical complexities. I am not a physicist, so I won't dive into that. And that is a totally different topic, but I think that's a very good observation.
And I think it's commendable for you to defend Zeno's paradoxes in that way as a practice, as a game, as something that could give us some insight as to how we think and why we think the way we do. As you say, testing the limits of what we can see as real, but also what we can imagine, which doesn't always line up with it. And that takes us very well into the second of Zeno's paradoxes that I wanted to touch on today, which is the arrow. Now, I'm surprised that you don't know of the arrow, Brandon, so well, because what you're talking about is exactly in line with it. So let me read you a little quote about that. So the third argument, this is a continued quote from the book I was talking about, the Simplicius work. So the third is that the flying arrow is at rest, which result follows from the assumption that time is composed of moments. He says that if everything when it occupies an equal space is at rest, and if that which is in locomotion is always in a now, the flying arrow is therefore motionless. From another work, from a Diogenes Laertius work, Zeno abolishes motion, saying what is in motion moves neither in the place it is, nor in one in which it is not. So this is the arrow, which basically, to translate that into simple terms, means if time is moments and in any given moment an object is occupying a certain space, that object is at rest in that space. But somehow, as time flows on, things move, or at least seem to us to move. And so this is the paradox that sort of puts the nail in the coffin of motion in the universe, through this explanation of the arrow. First, Zeno assumes that it travels no distance during that moment. It occupies an equal space for the whole instant, but the entire period of its motion contains only instants, all of which contain an arrow at rest. And so Zeno concludes the arrow can't be moving.
So if I can ask some questions and try and understand this, it seems that we've got these sort of temporal nodes, you know, now one, now two. The arrow is in these sort of temporal nodes. Where is the binding flow of motion that moves between them? Is that the question? The conclusion being that there is none, because they are broken up into these nodes, and so motion isn't really a thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's assumed that the instant is 0 seconds long, right? It's like a picture frame. And whatever speed the arrow has, speed is only distance over time, right? So if the instant is no time at all, in that time it can't be moving, because even if it has a speed, there is no time for it to travel distance, right? And so if you assume that life is made up of all of these snapshots put back to back, you actually technically don't have any movement by this logic, because it can't move during that any one instant where technically it's at rest. So yes, that is essentially the question and the answer that Zeno proposes, which is that things don't move. And of course, there are responses to this. A first response is to point out that determining the velocity of the arrow means dividing the distance traveled in some time by the length of that time. But assuming from now on that instants have zero duration, this formula makes no sense in the case of an instant. And so thus it is fallacious to conclude from the fact that the arrow doesn't travel any distance in an instant that it is at rest. And so I'll explain. This formula makes no sense in the case of an instant. The arrow travels 0 meters in the 0 seconds the instant lasts, but 0/0 meters per second is not any number at all. So that's the sort of mathematical answer to this, that you end up dividing 0 distance by 0 time. You don't get a number at all. And so assuming that an instant is 0 seconds just breaks the formula of motion. So that's one way to answer it. And then the other answer you could give is that motion is not something that happens at any instant, but rather only over finite periods of time. So it only gets from point X at time 1 to point Y at time 2, simply in virtue of being at successive intermediate points at successive intermediate times. It never changes its position during an instant, but only over intervals composed of instants. So basically you're breaking apart the idea that just because it may be at rest in any 0 second instant, it continues to move over a defined period of time. So that's kind of two responses to that. I don't want to dive, you know, again, too much into the nitty gritty of that, but anyways, I'll pass it back in case someone has something to add.
And I think something that's interesting here is that, like, even in modern day stuff, there are certain things that mathematicians just say, like, this is not defined. And that's because there is no good answer that we can think of for some of these situations, so to speak. One of those situations is like dividing by zero, because there isn't a physical intuition for that. We don't have a physical intuition for what it means to divide something by nothing. In fact, we didn't even have a mathematical intuition for the number zero. As interesting as these problems are, I think to some point, you also have to be aware of your own limits, the limits of understanding what limits can be, and just say some things are beyond us at this point in time.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I think, an important point about conceptualizing paradoxes in philosophy. The idea is that we try as much as possible to ground our thinking in things we can actually see in our world, right? Anything we try to explain even something like ethics that deal with concepts that are completely abstract, we try to ground in the world, right? Like we can point to something that is good, that is honorable, that is, we can give examples of the concepts that we make. Like Brandon said, it's sort of fun to think about these things because clearly it's possible for us to sort of imagine these scenarios. But if we can't ground it in anything real, it almost loses its... it loses its purpose as an explanatory device. And that opens up a whole other can of worms about, you know, different philosophers that have claimed that the world exists or doesn't exist, that there are things in the world or there aren't. Is it just our minds doing things? Is it actually things that, you know, we interact with? So that's a whole other can of worms. But I think, like you said, Brandon, it's an interesting thought experiment that tests how we approach the world around us.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment, but I also used the word spiritual practice too. It's a way of, like, think about going to like a mental gym or something. The more you think about this problem, maybe you don't ever unlock, you know, the answer. You don't figure out how, essentially, like, this is a physical model of dividing by zero if the criticism that you elaborated is correct. I think it is. It's pushing your mind against a sort of mental resistance. There seems to be something about that, you know, quote unquote, strengthens your mind or whatever. It makes you more apt when you go to things you can solve. These are good exercises for doing something like that. Again, what I'm doing here is I'm saying that solving the problem isn't the point. I don't think that attempts to solve them have been like misguided or anything like that, because obviously these are problems for mathematicians, so they got to solve their problems, but they're not problems to be solved for philosophers. They're, you know, they're mental weights to be lifted in a way, I guess.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting way to put that. There is something to be said about the fact that because they are so grounded in things we experience every day, they're examples of things we experience every day, that one could argue that it is our problem to understand them properly and understand why the world works the way it does. That's a lot of what we do as philosophers, right? And so in a sense, I don't know that I agree that it's not our problem, but I do agree that, as you say, it employs a kind of lateral thinking to get around different ways of solving it that is useful to apply to other scenarios too.
Yeah, and I do think this kind of just comes down to a sharp divide drawn in the Parmenidean project between what is really going on, reality, you know, well-rounded truth, and human delusions, human life. For some reason, inherently, we see things from a perspective, and Parmenides is interested in pointing to something beyond that, and almost in a way erasing or overcoming those human limitations, which that's a dangerous thing that you could be doing, but it's also just not easy at all. It's difficult to imagine actually doing that. We actually kind of want our world to have limits. We are humans. So again, I don't think that these things are to be overcome, mostly because that would look like destroying the human condition. What would, you know, if we were really like four-dimensional beings that didn't exist in time, that would be crazy. I would be freaking out. So are they our problems? Sure, but solving them would look like, you know, overcoming ourselves in a way.
Interesting way to put that. And like Aaron said, there are definitely movies out there and books that try to describe and demonstrate this stuff. So if that kind of brain break interests you, go ahead, have your fun, read some Parmenides. But
yeah, if you want to push yourself against dividing by zero, there are ways of doing it, apparently. And maybe your mind will finally figure it out, you know, who knows.
I do think that Brandon has a good point here, and that's that in confronting our limits, we often come to a better understanding of the human condition. The mathematician's perfect world is a world where you can prove everything that you want to from one inarguable premise. Is that Possible? Probably not. But if we could do that, if we had one premise that we, you know, universally, objectively knew was true, and we could prove all of mathematics from it, then, like, mathematicians would, like, that would be the, you know, the golden thing that all mathematicians would want. That's the kind of the ideal we strive for, is the least possible contradictions or the least possible paradoxes and the minimum amount of assumptions. Whether or not that ideal fits every type of problem that humans possess, I think you could argue that it doesn't, but I think that it also does fit a wide section of problems as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that, again, is a good way to end on the idea that we as philosophers kind of take a different approach to it, where we see all these problems that don't seem to have these perfect solutions, and we employ the use of argument and of logic to try and dig deep into these problems and figure out, you know, A, can we solve them? B, are they useful to us, solved or unsolved? I think that's part of what Brennan was talking about too, that these things may be useful to us, unsolved as they are. It's sort of our job to classify these things and to explore them, which is why paradoxes are so interesting. As you heard today, we talked through a couple of ancient examples of paradoxes, one more based in sort of common sense and contradiction that way, like we talked about with Euthyphro, employing ethics, and then, of course, Zeno, employing more sort of the logical approach, premises, and inferences. In the next episode, like I mentioned, we're going to dive into a little bit more the metaphysical side of things. So we're going to talk about identity, we're going to talk about how we perceive the objects that we're talking about in this episode, for example, through a couple of examples, Theseus's ship and the Christian paradoxes, things like how many angels on the head of a pin, and the communion, and the idea of the whole body of Christ in every piece of bread. So these are things we'll talk about in the next episode, but for now, I'm going to say thank you to Brendan and to Aaron for joining me on this discussion, Paradoxes in Philosophy, Part 1.
Archived recordings of The Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/The Canadian Philosophy Show and tcps.podbean.com.
Something wasn't wrong. You zoom right to my side to break. we call upon each other to guide what we'll pave. We can't be estranged.